now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us this morning some high school students. We have with us Lincoln High School. Let the students please stand so we can greet them. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we also have with us Williams Bay High School. Would those students please stand? And we're delighted to have you with us, too. You may be seated. These students are here with a program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And the program involves our inviting students to come to an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, then these students are given the briefs of the case that they are to hear, and the students may engage in other activities relating to this case. And the last aspect of the program is that the students meet with a justice of this court at lunchtime. The lunchtime discussion is open to everyone, not only the students, but everyone. And the discussion relates to the procedures of the court, not the substantive issue of the cases you are about to hear. So let me, before we call the case, introduce the court to you all. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet at lunch today. To Justice Bradley's left is Justice David Prosser, and to his left is Justice Lewis Butler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I will call the first case, 2004 AP 1592 CR, State versus Thomas S. Mayo. Arguing for Mr. Mayo is Attorney Keith Finley of the Frank Remington Center, UW Law School, Madison. Mr. Finley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. There is no dispute in this case that the prosecutor engaged in improper argument. There's no real dispute, at least according to the lower courts, that some of this improper argument was serious. The real question before this court here today is whether the courts will do anything about this misconduct. The answer, of course, that I'm here to argue for is to that question should be yes. This is an appropriate case for this court to do something about such misconduct for several reasons. First, the misconduct in this case represented no mere inadvertent slips of the tongue. The improper argument was pervasive and serious. Yet prosecutors, defense attorneys, and to some extent judges alike seem not to have understood or to recognize it fully. Courts and commentators alike are increasingly recognizing that to stem the tide of improper closing arguments, courts must do more than condemn such arguments while continuing to affirm as they did in this case.
Counsel, I know that's your argument. Tell me exactly what were the improper. There is a dispute, although I recognize the fact that the trial judge said, okay, this was improper, but we're going to continue the trial. Tell me exactly what was the offending statement.
Well, there was more than one.
There were. And then there was some discourse between the defense counsel and between the prosecutor. I mean, there were comments on both sides, but go ahead.
Yes. The first instance of improper argument began in transcript what reads as the second paragraph of the prosecutor's opening portion of her closing argument, when she told the jury, the way a criminal case works is police reports are forwarded into the district attorney's office, we review them, we determine whether there should be a charge or there shouldn't be a charge, we have the discretion to do that. She went on to describe her
offer. Now, tell me, just because your opposing counsel says, look, that's just kind of common knowledge. That's what they do. And you think that that's improper?
I think it's clearly improper for several reasons. Number one, there's no evidence in the record to support how a criminal case works, what kind of discretion the district attorney's office has, whether they reviewed police reports, whatever they did. And I think it's not accurate to say that that's common knowledge. I mean, think about the criminal justice system itself. It took until the 1950s with the American Bar Foundation studies before even people who worked in the criminal justice system, judges and lawyers, before we even recognized that discretion played a big part in the process. I think it's not common knowledge to average citizens, to jurors, to understand how much discretion plays a role. Surely the jury knew that the prosecutor had a role in prosecuting, but it's not at all clear that jurors understood how deep that discretion goes. But more significantly, I think, the real problem here is that with this comment and with the additional comments is that the prosecutor was telling the jury, don't worry about it. I've checked this case out already. I've reviewed it. I know it's just. I know he's guilty. Therefore, defer to my judgment instead of your own independent judgment of the facts. And that is a very serious problem recognized by other courts, by this court, by the United States Supreme Court. It suggests to the jury that there are facts out there that maybe the jury hasn't heard, but the prosecutor has heard, and it cloaks the conclusion of guilt with the imprimatur of the prosecutor's high office.
With regard to your argument regarding the arguments, what's your stronger argument? Plain error or interest of justice?
I don't know that I could say which is stronger. I'd say either of them is available. I would say that I think it is plain error because it's plain and it's fundamental. It violates the defendant's constitutional rights. But in a sense, it might be a cleaner and easier way for this court to get at it, to approach it in the interest of justice. Because that is an avenue that allows this court to do the right thing regardless of technical or mechanical rules. And it is an authority that this court has used before, and it's an authority that the Court of Appeals has used to correct instances of improper closing argument absent objection. So I think they're both available, as is ineffective assistance of counsel. I think all of them work quite well. Perhaps the interest of justice.
Let me tell you, with regard to the interest of justice, I think that one of the prongs of interest of justice is a substantial probability of a different result, or words to that effect. The circuit court here made a specific determination of credibility, and your client ended up on the short end of that stick. The circuit court said because Thomas Mayo's appearance as a witness removed all doubt as to his credibility and the believability of the testimony of Clarence Price was never seriously questioned or challenged. So you found your client incredible, as I read it, and Price's credibility never questioned or challenged. So how can, with that kind of finding on credibility, how can you prevail on a substantial probability of a different result?
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. One is you're highlighting one of the prongs or one of the different types of interest of justice new trial. And that is, I think, that for the miscarriage of justice, I do carry the burden of proving a probability of a different outcome. But there is another prong, which is that the real controversy was not fully tried. And it's very clear in the law that I don't have to meet that burden in order for this court to grant a new trial because the real controversy was not fully tried. And that's the prong that the Court of Appeals, for example, in State versus Neuser, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, why they granted a new trial in the interest of justice based on prosecutorial misconduct, because the arguments risk inviting the jury to decide the case on something other than the evidence presented to the jury. And that's sort of a commonality that runs throughout all of the errors in this case. That risk is there, and so this is an appropriate case for that. But even if we were to look at the question of whether there is a reasonable probability of a different outcome, which, of course, is a consideration if we're looking at this as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, even under that standard, I don't think the judge's conclusions about his sense of Clarence Price's credibility versus Thomas Mayo's credibility is what controls here, because the question is not the judge's determination of their credibility, but the jury's determination of their credibility. And in this case, I think there are, in fact, significant reasons to doubt Clarence Price's credibility just as much as Thomas Mayo's credibility. Clarence Price was a young man, 18 years of age, who already had two felony convictions. He told a rather bizarre story about encountering a man he knew on the street who, out of the blue, robbed him. And then Clarence claims that he didn't call police immediately, but he was on the home, on the driveway of a friend, so he went into that friend's home and called his mother there. That friend, Jarrell, never testified. The mother never testified. Mother says, call police. So does he call police? No. He wanders two more blocks somewhere else to a third person's home, never identified who that person is, calls police from there, he says. That person never testifies either. This case was terribly undertried.
Counsel, your argument asserts a premise that is foreign to me. Doesn't mean that it's not right, but it's just not one with which I am familiar. And that is, your argument is based on the premise that the trial court's determination regarding credibility here is irrelevant because it was tried to a jury. I don't know that to be the law, and yet that was the stepping stone of all of your comments that just followed.
I don't mean to say that it's irrelevant. I don't think that would be appropriate. But what I am saying is that the trial court is not, in the final instance, the judge of credibility in the sense that the trial judge decides which one to believe and, therefore, which one should prevail.
Let me be more pointed in my question. What role, if any, does the trial court's determination of credibility play here, and what deference do we owe to it?
To be honest, that's a question that I think isn't resolved in the case law. I think it's a factor this court can consider. But it's not the ultimate consideration. I think this court has a duty and an obligation to look at the entire record.
Well, in determining prejudice, if you're going to do that as to the closing statement, or you're going to do it as to the ineffective assistance of counsel, or you're going to do it as to the hearsay issue, all of these three issues seem to be a main point. It would seem to me you can deal with prejudice, you have to deal with the jury. Because the jury did the conviction here.
That's right. And I think the test is not, does the judge believe one witness or the other, but might this jury have been influenced one way or the other? Might it have affected this jury?
Your point, if I may, is well taken. I mean, I understand that. And I have a problem that needs to be worked through. And the problem is, and let me exaggerate for emphasis, if a judge after a jury trial says one witness is a lying, thieving sneak that I didn't believe one word from the witness stand. Well, that kind of comes into my mind, into the analysis as to whether or not there's a likelihood of success on the merits of retry. I mean, it's in here, you know, and we are so often in other contexts, perhaps, attuned to saying the court's determinations on credibility are to be given some deference. Now, I realize there's a jury trial here, but I guess I'm asking you how, if I give weight to the jury, to the trial court's determination that your client's a liar and not to be believed, that alters my analysis.
There is a record here upon which this court made that determination. First off, I believe one of the things the court said was the jury didn't buy Thomas Mayo's version. So that's sort of circular in that sense, because the question is whether or not the jury was influenced by the improper arguments. But the court also gave reasons as to why he thought Thomas Mayo was not as credible as Clarence Price. And we can dissect those reasons, and we can analyze and understand that in some regards, I think the court was just simply wrong. in his analysis of why Thomas Mayo was less credible. He said, for example, that it made no sense that Thomas Mayo would claim that he asked the people in the Mexican restaurant to call police, and yet when Clarence Price left the doorway, he fled from the restaurant. Well, does it really make no sense? Of course it makes perfect sense. He's in the restaurant asking them to call police. Clarence Price is at the doorway threatening him, yelling at him, and the people in the restaurant are saying, leave, get out of here, we don't want you around, or we'll call the police on you. Well, it's a rather helter-skelter kind of environment. It's not a very positive reception he's getting in the restaurant. It makes perfect sense that when his antagonizer leaves the door to the restaurant, he would, in fact, take that opportunity to run. So just as a matter of that's just one example of how we can analyze the trial court's rationale here, the logic behind it, and say, you know, that's not entirely accurate. It's not the only interpretation. In fact, it's maybe not even the best interpretation. And therefore, despite what the trial court concluded here, this court can look at that record and say, you know, there is a possibility that the jury might look at it differently than the trial court did, and that the jury might look at it differently if all of the features that made this such an undertried case, if all of the weaknesses had not been bolstered in this case.
Counselor, aren't you really saying that you give no weight to the trial court's finding? I think that's what Justice Bradley is trying to pin you down on. Do we give it weight, or do we review the record de novo and make our own decision? Which is it?
Well, that's a complicated question. If you're deciding ineffective assistance of counsel, the question of prejudice is a de novo review. So in that sense, I think, no, it's certainly not controlling. It may be part of what goes into your totality of the review, but you have a duty and an obligation and an opportunity to engage in de novo review of that. Is it a non-factor? No, I think it's a factor. Is it a significant? No, because you have the record before you.
But Counselor, I think that when we look at credibility, we have tons of cases that say credibility is not for an appellate court. Though we weigh whether there's sufficient evidence to show that the defendant was prejudiced, we don't, in any case that I'm aware of, do it based on a determination of credibility. And I think that's kind of what's bothering Justice Bradley, and that's bothering me too, because we've got the trial court out there saying all of this. Now, if you're telling us, because we're looking at ineffective assistance of counsel and because prejudice is de novo review, it doesn't matter whether credibility is the factor that it turns on here, then we still do it de novo. I can understand if that's your position. I guess I just want to know, what is your position?
That is part of my position. Part of my position also is that in the interest of justice analysis, a probability of a different outcome is not part of the equation when you're talking about the question being whether the real controversy was fully tried. So we don't need to get bogged down on that. Because the question simply before you is, did this prosecutor inject this case with so much extraneous, improper argument that it prevented the real controversy from being fully tried?
Mr. Finley, let me come at this another way. My understanding is the trial court looked at the objections that you're repeating here and said, you know, in context, there were a number of mistakes, but they don't undermine my confidence in the fairness of the result. That's basically what the Court of Appeals said as well, that, okay, you know, the prosecutor said some things she should not have said. There may be some other errors here, but on balance, this was a fair trial producing a fair result. How do you respond to that? I think we're all coming at that basically in a little different way, but we're all saying the same thing. Do we give that no weight? What the trial court determined at looking at the entire trial?
I think if we're talking ineffective assistance of counsel, the question of whether there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome, because you do make, that's a constitutional question, it's a de novo review.
I agree.
But yes, you do make your own independent judgment on that. If the question is whether to grant a new trial in the interest of justice, again, it's very clear that this court has independent discretion.
But we also accept the facts as determined by the circuit court, as you know. It's a mixed question when you get to the issues.
Yes.
In regard to ineffective assistance of counsel. And so we can't just ignore what the trial court said in terms of credibility, what the trial court said in terms of whether or not there was an undermining of the fairness of the result.
I'm not here to argue that the judge's impressions about credibility are utterly irrelevant to any of this analysis. Yes, it's there. It's something for you to consider. But I don't think it's controlling, because you have this responsibility and because you have a record you can review. And because the interest of justice reversal serves not only, I think, not only to correct the injustice in this case, but also an opportunity for this Court to send a message.
Well, let me ask you about that. Can't we send a message that this kind of comment by prosecutors, and frankly also by the defense attorney, we don't like this. It's inappropriate. It shouldn't be going on in trials. Can't we say that without reversing a conviction here?
You can. I doubt that it will be very effective. Numerous courts, numerous commentators have commented on the fact that courts continually do that. They keep saying, we don't approve. We condemn this conduct. And then they affirm. And the message that comes through is, we can get away with it. Nobody pays a whole lot of attention to it. And what the courts and commentators, for example, the Minnesota Supreme Court recently held, and various commentators have said, if we really are serious about condemning this, we have to do something about it. We have to send the message clearly, and the only way the message is clearly heard is if we say we're going to reverse in cases where the misconduct is serious and at least where the evidence is close, and I think this is one clearly.
How about ethical rules that make it clear and ethical rules that can indeed result in discipline of lawyers? Isn't that something that carries some basis short of reversing a conviction?
It can. Ethical rules and ethical discipline certainly is one route. The problem is you don't see it enforced very often, but more fundamentally, invoking an ethical sanction against the prosecutor for doing this does nothing to remedy the wrong that was done to Thomas Mayo. So you have both the message sending and the injustice that was done in this case. You have to look at what happened to Thomas Mayo here. And the simple reality is the prosecutor injected this case with extraneous, improper considerations that affected Thomas Mayo's rights. An ethics violation, a sanction for an ethics violation, doesn't address that at all.
I don't know why you just don't say, you ignore what the trial court said about credibility. This defendant is entitled to a jury trial. That's what he's entitled to. And the estranged case if the court did not allow somebody to testify because the court didn't believe in the credibility of the witness. And on appeal and on review, the test is for the jury. So why don't you just bite the bullet and say that the heck with the trial judge?
You know, I think you may be right about that. I think it gets to the core here, which is why certainly the trial court's judgment on that can't be dispositive. And I think you may be right that as I said, because you have a record before you to review, that it really...
Which we do as a matter of law under the two issues of effect.
I'm sorry?
Which we do as a matter of law under the... 751-06 and ineffective assistance.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think you are correct that the question is he's entitled to a jury determination on.
That's what you're fighting about, that he didn't get a fair jury determination.
No, you're absolutely right about that. I think.
But don't be so sure. You got six other people here.
I recognize that. Okay. I do think that's right. Whether the court's assessment that Mayo wasn't credible plays no role or some small role, I really don't know how to tell you that. But what I do know is that what's at stake here is the right to a jury determination based on a fair presentation of the evidence, and that's why the trial judge's assessment of credibility can't be controlling.
I'm kind of interested, Mr. Finley, on what the obligations of defense counsel are in terms of argument. I used to be a district attorney, and I remember quite well being accused by defense counsel repeatedly of sort of manufacturing evidence and I was just terribly corrupt. Of course, none of it was true. But, I mean, I heard it in every case. How's the balance here? And does that kind of argument sort of open the door when prosecution might say?
Well, there's a couple of aspects to that. One, I think the first defense counsel's first responsibility is to object. Is to object to improper arguments. And one of the things that I see reviewing appellate records is the defense lawyers don't get it. And that's another reason why I think a reversal here is needed, is to wake people up and say, look, this is a serious problem. You need to be paying attention to it. The other part of your question is, I think, is getting at the question of whether defense counsel here in this case engaged in misconduct himself. By overstating his argument, what he thought the prosecutor was at. Is that what you're getting at there?
That's part of it, yeah.
Yeah, I agree that the defense counsel argued inartfully when he analogized the news about Saddam Hussein. That was not a good choice of analogies. But I think if you look at what he was trying to do, he wasn't trying to call the prosecutor a brutal dictator, an enemy of the United States. He was simply trying to illustrate a point that simply repeating a fact over and over again doesn't make it so. That's clearly what he was saying there. The only other thing that was arguably improper in the defense lawyer's argument here was when he said, she's spinning the evidence in her way. I can't see how that was improper argument here, though, given that it was the prosecutor who first said the defense will spin the evidence when they get up here. Then defense counsel said she's spinning it her way. And then defense counsel also said, now here's my spin. If that's an insult to her, I fail to see how, because she introduced spin first. He responded with spin and said, we're both doing it. Now it's my turn. That's not an insult to the prosecutor. That's just simply saying we're all both trying to show you how the evidence can be interpreted in the light most favorable to us. That's very different than what the prosecutor argued here. When she told the jury that my job is to review the case with exercising discretion to see that justice is done, it's not his job to see that justice is done. It's his job to get his client off the hook. That's very different.
I'm interested in the open file discussion. In your view, if the prosecution wants to use that, or maybe they shouldn't use it, we'll see, but if they want to use that, do they have to put on witnesses of all the procedure followed in the district attorney's office?
That's the rule. That's the law. If the prosecutor wants to argue about a fact, the prosecutor has to present evidence about it. Now, my guess is the prosecutor wouldn't put on evidence of it because it's probably not admissible, because it's not relevant, and it probably raises suggestions about comments on silence after Miranda warnings were given, which is clearly impermissible. So that suggests perhaps another reason why this is wrong. But yes, the answer is, if the prosecutor wants to argue about process, about steps anything went through, she'd better introduce evidence and make sure it meets the standards for proper evidence. That wasn't done here. See that I'm out of time.
Is it improper argument to say that the defendant has had a certain amount of time to think of an explanation for his conduct? I mean, and how do you establish the amount of time?
I that's one that wasn't raised in the lower courts, and I see I'm beyond my time. Can I respond?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Finley.
But as I think about it and as I've prepared for this argument, it occurs to me, I think that probably is improper argument in this sense. What it's telling the jury is, he's had access to all of this information for all these many, many months. After he was charged, after he was Mirandized, and he didn't say anything until now, he's had 5 months to think about it, and now for the first time he's saying something. That is an improper comment in itself on the defendant's invocation of his Miranda rights prohibited by Doyle versus Ohio. So I do think that that's an improper kind of argument to make as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General James Freinuth, representing the state of Wisconsin. Counsel?
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state as respondent in this criminal case. Racine County jury found defendant Thomas Mayo guilty of three crimes, armed robbery, battery, and obstruction. Court of Appeals affirmed, and the state asks this court to affirm. Before addressing the specific claims of error, there are three holdings or conclusions that the state would ask this court to consider on the subject of prejudice. First, this court should hold that when a defendant alleges that unobjected to errors occurred at trial and seeks a retrial on that basis, on alternative grounds of ineffective counsel, plain error, and interest of justice, the reviewing court should always first examine the claim under the Strickland test of ineffective counsel. If the defendant cannot make the Strickland showing of prejudice, the reviewing court should reverse for plain error or interest of justice only if there is something much more problematic going on in the case than counsel's ineffectiveness. If you don't look at Strickland first and look at plain error and interest of justice, then Strickland has no meaning in cases of unobjected error. You'd completely ignore Strickland. Why ever bother about Strickland if the prejudice standard of plain error and interest of justice somehow can stand in Strickland's stead?
But isn't there a prejudicial aspect to plain error and discretionary justice?
Exactly right.
The burden is on a different party.
Well, that was that was where I was going with this.
Okay,
next
go
point.
Ahead.
And that's what plain error is, and that I would ask the court to clarify that the plain error test is the test articulated by this court in Virgil in 1978. And it's at 84 Wissecond, and I'm quoting here briefly at page 190. Quote, plain error on its face is ipso facto prejudicial. And once plain error is determined, no inquiry in respect to whether it is prejudicial is necessary or permissible. In light of this standard, the Court of Appeals statements in the King and Neely decisions in suggesting that once plain error is found, the state must show lack of prejudice are inaccurate. Rather, under Virgil, prejudice is embodied in the analysis of plain error itself. It's part of the determination of plain error. If you've got plain error, you've got prejudice. That's all part of the same analysis.
Well, counsel, before you move on to your second point, you're arguing for what sounds like a new rule here. Do you have any cases in support of your position that we should start with Strickland and then work down?
Not in Wisconsin, I don't, Your Honor, no. I'm not aware of any case that spells it out in that direction.
Any from the U.S. Supreme Court?
Not that I'm aware of.
You just think it's good practice.
I do, and I think it makes logical sense. I've seen several cases where all these various claims of error are raised. And most frequently where a problem arises, and I'll address this as well, in the interest of justice standard has two alternative tests. One is the miscarriage of justice, where a substantial probability of a different result is the standard. So that's like Strickland's prejudice test, only even a little more serious error. What happens, though, is defendants want to skirt the prejudice prong of Strickland or of the interest of justice, miscarriage of justice part of the test, and go right to the real controversy test. Because there's no requirement of showing prejudice. Two things about the interest of justice, real controversy prong. One is that this court in Hicks, and I'm not sure if there's a more recent opinion, indicated that that the real controversy part of the interest of justice test only goes to evidentiary errors. That is, where there was significant evidence that the jury didn't hear, or conversely, if there was significant evidence that should have been excluded from the jury. Both the plain error and interest of justice tests, both prongs, are discretionary tests for this court. So when we're talking about, for example, the credibility of the trial court's post-conviction determinations here, when you're talking about discretionary reversal here, where you're going to that type of serious error, the trial court's credibility determinations, fact-finding, opinion, view of the evidence, view of the closing arguments firsthand, all comes into play in assessing whether there has been reversible error, whether it does amount to that serious error. Now, when you're looking at Strickland, the prejudice prong of Strickland already accounts for much of that analysis, I think, because there the defendant has to show a reasonable probability of a different result. So in that context, you're looking at all of the evidence that occurred in the case, cautionary instructions, the nature of the error, the frequency of the error, that sort of thing.
I'm not so sure I'm getting your point here. What's your answer to the questions that were raised by the court as to the effect that should be given to the judge's determination of credibility under these three tests?
Right. Under Strickland, I think the credibility determination of the trial court is going to be primarily in factual findings, where there's deferential. When it comes to the ultimate application of Strickland to the case, this court has said that it's a question of law. And to that extent, as a question of law, it's reviewed de novo. What I'm suggesting is that in the other severe prejudice tests that are discretionary.
But the facts in Strickland go to, did the counsel do a good job? So how does the credibility of one of the witnesses go to the issue, did the attorney, that's the first step in Strickland, did the attorney perform reasonably? I mean, what has that credibility got to do with it? Now, I can see where the judge then says, okay, counsel might have objected, but the fact that didn't, and that these prosecutor statements went in, and the hearsay evidence went in, that did not undermine my confidence in the, I'm not giving you the Strickland test perfectly, but didn't undermine my confidence in the reliability, because I think that everyone here would know that Mayo is incredible, or he didn't, however you want to phrase it. Therefore, it didn't undermine. I mean, that's not a finding of fact. That's a balancing of everything on prejudice.
Sure,
the facts are not, have nothing to do with this. The fact of credibility doesn't have anything to do with, I don't think, counsel's behavior.
Well, I think it's inconsistent to suggest that where you're making a legal determination that the trial court's credibility determination, which covers things as, you know, witness testimony, view of the facts of the case, its own, for example, in closing argument, whether it felt it needed to intercede or not, things like that color the court's ultimate conclusion. But the ultimate conclusion of fact, I agree, is deferential, and credibility does not color that.
It's opposed to the question of law that we're doing, not a factual finding
right.
In the case.
That's right.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Sure. I want to follow up to make sure I understand that clarification. Then you're saying that the judge's credibility determination in the two-part Strickland test really does not fall in under either part. I mean, that a judge's conclusion regarding credibility is not historical fact.
No. I'm sorry if I misspoke. What I'm suggesting is that when the trial court is making fact findings, as a post-conviction court, for example, in an ineffective counsel setting, those fact findings are entitled deference unless they're clearly erroneous. And part of the determination of fact is going to be credibility determinations with respect to witnesses. And in that context, that's important. I'm also suggesting, though, that the trial court has, I don't know if credibility is the right description for it, but when the trial court is confronted, for example, with closing arguments and deciding whether I should step in even though a defense counsel is not saying anything, that type of assessment also, I think, colors the view of the nature of the error. But when you're talking about the specific tests, when it's an ultimate question of law, that is de novo review. At least when you're doing the legal, the whole story.
I have a problem in that in my analysis, I don't see credibility as a historical fact. I see it as a conclusion, and that we have a separate area of jurisprudence dealing with our deference to credibility, but not based on historical fact. So that's just my mindset difference.
But I think that you'd agree, because to make a determination on ineffective assistance of counsel as to the first step, don't have to determine credibility of the witness, do you?
Well, in making fact findings, for example, if you have two witnesses who say opposite things, the trial court has to make a determination who it's going to believe in a post-conviction setting, a non-jury setting.
Isn't the problem here that it's the jury that's supposed to make the determination? And so if you have, as defense counsel arguing that, we haven't decided this yet, but if this court were to agree with the defendant that there are facts that are being argued outside of the record in the closing arguments that would have an impact on a jury's credibility determination, the jury has been deprived of the opportunity to make that determination. Isn't that really what the issue is here?
Well, when you're talking about closing argument, and this is one of the points I was going to get to, I think there's two things you have to look at. The nature of the statement of the prosecutor in this case that's being objected to, and whether that is improper. And even with that, you still have, under any of these tests, whether it's Strickland, plain error, or interest of justice, you should look at whether or not the case is a close case, the strength of the state's case. And my suggestion is that when you've got, even if you've got error in a closing argument by the prosecutor, reversal is not the appropriate remedy unless it's the type of egregious, unless you have a combination of two things, egregious error and a close case, which this case is not.
Let me ask you about that, because the one thing that I find troubling about the case, given my experience in the criminal area, you've got a drug deal gone bad, as I understand the facts. You have two bad actors here. You have no independent witnesses who testify. And a jury is asked to determine which of the bad actors is the worst of the bad actors. There's no dispute that there was a confrontation on two separate dates. We understand that. You have an argument about what that confrontation was involved, whether a person was ripped off of $35 as part of a drug deal, or whether or not he was committing an armed robbery. Now, this is what's before the jury, and they have to make a determination. And then, as I understand defense counsel's argument, you have the prosecutor coming in and saying, well, we've assessed all this. We decide what to try. You know, we put all this before you. And there's something, I'm not sure that this case is as clear on its merits as the state makes it out to be, or as the defense makes it out to be. To me, I look at these facts, and it's like, okay, which liar do I believe? Flip a coin.
With all due respect, the state's case was not that this was necessarily a drug deal gone bad. The state's case, based on the complainant, was that he was walking on the street. The defendant crosses the street. He recognizes the defendant because he had been introduced to him through the uncle. The defendant knew the victim's uncle. And then the victim said the defendant asked him for a dollar, and as he was reaching into his pocket, hit him on the head with a gun, kicked him in the stomach, stomped on his head, and took $35 from him. Now, the defendant's story was that he was going to buy cocaine, that he gave him $35. When Price gave him four bags and he felt that that wasn't enough cocaine, that's when he started to attack the victim. And, in fact, even in that situation, although this wasn't the state's theory at trial, you arguably have a robbery here, because after he's
saying $35,
after he gave him $35, he no longer had a right of possession in that. So at a minimum, without take away the armed part, but at a minimum here, you've got a robbery as well as a battery. And I think, and then when you throw in the fact that the defendant had inconsistent behavior and inconsistent statements, which I'm glad to catalog here in a minute, I don't think you really have a close case here. And I think that's where the trial court was trying to put context to its post-conviction rulings about the closing argument. And before I go into the facts, because I think I want to address, if I may, what I think this court could consider doing with respect to concerns it has about closing argument. To the extent it's concerned that closing arguments remain civil in criminal cases, there are several options short of reversing convictions in cases like this one that aren't, in the state's opinion, close cases. For example, first, this court could signal trial courts to be alert to interrupt improper argument. chastise offending counsel at the bench, or warn counsel in front of the jury in certain cases if necessary, and then issue an appropriate curative instruction.
You want that done even if defense counsel doesn't object?
In certain cases where it's a clear improper argument. Excuse me. Secondly, this court could also signal that in more egregious cases of improper argument, trial courts could consider ordering forfeiture of further argument by counsel. In other words, at the bench, tell counsel to tell the jury thank you and then sit down. And in the worst scenario, as this court already mentioned earlier, to stem the worst violations, this court could promote the existing ethics rule, which is 20:8.3a, the existing rule that requires counsel and courts at all levels to report suspected ethics violations to OLR. Although I hasten here that this doesn't come close to that. The trial court, court of appeals, trial counsel, defense appellate counsel, nobody has suggested that there were any ethical violations committed here in closing argument.
That might be good for the future. It doesn't help Mr. Mayo.
That's true. But I'm suggesting, to reiterate, that you have to look at the nature of the case and the facts and the absence of prejudice here.
Mr. Bramlett, I would have thought you would have been more comfortable arguing the waiver point. I mean, defense counsel, after all, has an obligation, has a duty to object when argument is improper. And one of the problems with imposing upon the circuit judge a responsibility of interrupting an argument is there may be actual tactical reasons why defense counsel chooses not to object. And defense counsel may be setting a trap that they can spring in response argument. There are other reasons why the trial court should be reticent to jump in.
Absolutely.
So to impose that duty on the trial judge troubles me.
Right, and I understand it. And this was a tricky proposition. It's one of these where you're on the fly, you have to decide, do I step in or don't I step in, and how is that going to impact on the case? I hesitate to go too far with this, but with respect to, in this case, defense counsel at post-conviction suggested, A, it was rude, he didn't believe that it was the appropriate thing to do, and second, he thought the jury instructions would cover the instructions about closing argument as an evidence, that the charging document, the information, is not evidence to be considered, that I think that was the primary instructions.
Well, my recollection is that we've got cases saying you leave a little latitude in opening and closing.
Right.
That it's bad form, unless it's, you know, over the top, for one counsel to interrupt another during opening and closing. I mean, this is a chance for rhetoric.
It's a tricky proposition on a couple of levels because it's a fluid thing. It's spoken extemporaneously in closing argument. I think, for example, in this case, the offensive comments primarily that the defendant is complaining about occurred in the prosecutor's rebuttal argument after she heard the words Saddam Hussein and spinning the evidence. Now, whether she was accurate in her or off the point that the defense counsel was trying to make, when you're in the middle of this, your reaction sometimes your words, your precise choice of words, just like here at oral argument, aren't always exactly what you're trying to convey. And where you've got a strong case as this is, you don't want to reverse lightly because it's not fair to the complainant or the public in those situations. And with respect, again, on the strength of the state's case here, which I think is where the state's strongest argument probably lies here, that there wasn't prejudice from admittedly argument about the prosecutor's role or defense counsel's role that probably was or should, I wouldn't even say probably, exceeded proper argument because these aren't facts of the case being talked about.
So did you agree that that the state assistant district attorney shouldn't have talked about open files?
I think open files, probably I agree with defense counsel that it's a question of fact that unless you're putting that in for some relevant purpose, and it escapes me right now as to why it would be relevant, but I think it's also appropriate in the same breath to say that, to suggest that when the defendant has had a chance, for example, to hear all the testimony before he testifies, and or perhaps that he has read, in preparation with his counsel, read police reports, That probably goes a little far because that's not necessarily a fact, but certainly that he's been in the courtroom to hear the testimony, that don't believe him because he's had a chance here to fix and adjust as necessary to fit the physical evidence, for example, or the state's case.
If you take the stand, you can say you didn't say any of that before. Can you say that?
I'm sorry?
Can you tell the defendant, if the defendant takes the stand, that was not explained before?
That he didn't say that before?
Yeah.
Yeah, you mean the Miranda violation?
No.
Or?
That the police report doesn't show he said this before. Let's take that.
Well, he certainly can respond to the state's evidence. Sorry if I'm missing.
No, go ahead.
With respect to the strength of the state's case, just a few points that I'd quickly like to emphasize. First, after the encounter, Price immediately called his mother and then the police. And when police arrived, the timing of this was such that he was still bleeding from the cut on his head. So this was relatively short span of time. With respect to Mr. Mayo's lack of credibility, this is demonstrated in several respects. Although Mr. Mayo volunteered at trial that he had a cocaine habit, he said that when he took back the cash that he had given to, in this alleged drug deal that he had given to the seller, he didn't take the cocaine. Jurors had to wonder if he was so upset about being shorted on cocaine that he would go about beating and kicking this guy, as he admitted, why wouldn't he take the cocaine as well? The next day when he encountered Mayo outside a restaurant.
Maybe he was high.
It's perhaps the case. On that point, I'll just add that Mr. Mayo, as the jury was told, had 8 prior convictions.
He didn't exercise the best of judgment.
The next day is the outside-the-restaurant encounter, and according to Mr. Mayo, he claimed that he went inside, told employees to call the police because Clarence Price had been hitting him with a tire iron, and apparently there was evidence that he had a cut on his hand and got blood on his shirt. But when restaurant employees were going to do that, he fled the restaurant instead of waiting for police. Again, inconsistent behavior, showing a lack of credibility, showing if, in fact, he did that, it wouldn't make sense if he was going to then run away. And while...
I'm sorry, that's one I'm having trouble swallowing. I think of all the incidents that are taking place out there where an individual, and I know you've dealt with these cases on appeal, where an individual is in a bar, two individuals are in a bar, one leaves after uttering a threat, returns seconds or minutes later with a gun and shoots the other. And that happens all of the time. So to argue that a person is leaving the bar when a person walks out of the door, to say that makes no sense to me, because we know what happens all of the time, and when it happens in that fashion, somebody ends up shot. I mean, that just doesn't wash for me.
Okay, I guess I'm not quite following, but
you have two individuals in the restaurant, and you have one of the individuals, as I understood the facts, utters a threat and then turns and leaves. When that individual turns and leaves, Mayo takes off.
Sure. I'm not saying it's illogical for him to do that, but I'm saying it's inconsistent for him to say, well, I called the police. He could have just stayed there and waited for police. I understand that people don't always react logically and that, you know, maybe I can just get away. But certainly a logical
response. Maybe you're missing the import of my question. If he is concerned, and I don't know whether he is or not, but if the concern is that when Price left the restaurant, he left the restaurant to back up his threat, and he's going to return with a weapon, so I'm going to get out of here before something happens. That happens all the time. That's why I say when I saw the state's argument, it's like, no, that doesn't work.
I understand that. I say that is an understandable type of response, but what I'm saying is, why would he say he called the police and just not wait inside the restaurant? As good enough a response, or even a more logical response, if you will.
Because he doesn't know how long the police are going to take to
come.
That's
true. That's true.
And he may as well get if the getting is good, which may be a mistake.
I grant it is not the best point in terms of this of strength, but it is it's another reflection of lack of credibility, I guess. Also, when he did run, Price stayed on the phone with police to monitor the flight, and then Mayo ran in, hid in a stranger's house, and when police announced their presence, again, if he was concerned about his own safety and well-being or even getting rid of a crack pipe that he said he had, he certainly had opportunities to do that at any point along the way. But then he stays inside the house for 20 to 40 seconds before even responding to police.
One of the difficulties in asserting that you have a strong case is the argument advanced by your opposing counsel that there's ineffective assistance of counsel, trial counsel. That is, trial counsel undertried the case, failed to order a transcript of the preliminary hearing testimony so that he could adequately impeach Price, failed to call witnesses, which he should have known or had reason to know was right there at the scene, and that apparently was going to testify favorably to Mayo, found out afterwards anyway. So their premise is whatever case that you have is infirm because the trial attorney blew it. So how can you argue you have a strong case?
Well, I think you have to look, obviously, at individual claims of ineffectiveness. For example, the not presenting Argo McMorris was this missing witness who would have said that on the day after the – she was not a witness to the battery, the alleged robbery battery, so she wouldn't have been helpful with respect to that. She said that on the day after she was a longtime friend or acquaintance of Mr. Mayo. She'd known him since he was a child. So that bears in part on her credibility. But she would have said that he flagged down the police and that he had a knot on his head, neither of which Mr. Mayo himself said he did. And with respect to the trial court even knowing about this witness, defense counsel knowing about this witness, the trial court, and something I missed in my brief but discovered in preparation today, in it, at page 12 of its decision, the trial court makes a fact finding that it did not believe Mr. Mayo but believed defense counsel when defense counsel said, Mr. Mayo never told me about Argo McMorris. The other aspect of ineffective assistance, specifically apart from the failure to object to the closing argument, is about impeaching Clarence Price, the complainant, with preliminary testimony to the effect that at the prelim, Price had said there was another person with fur across his or her face, meaning presumably a jacket covering the face. But the timing of that and the meaning of that isn't absolutely clear. I mean, without development, who knows what that meant? Mr. Mayo never claimed that there was a witness to this or that he was accompanied by anybody else, for example. The witness could have disappeared before Mr. Mayo crossed the street. So it's not evidence of any kind of import. So when you look at individual aspects of what the ineffective allegations are, there just isn't much there. And some cases, quite frankly, just don't, you know, from the defendant's standpoint, there just isn't much you can do.
Mr. Feinmuth, I have one question about the second issue in the case, the issue of the excited utterances.
Okay.
I'm looking from one of the, what I consider to be one of the principal cases dealing with excited utterances, Christensen versus Economy Fire and Casualty Company, on page 58 of that opinion. The statements of a declarant who demonstrates the opportunity and capacity to review the accident and to calculate the effect of his statements do not qualify as excited utterances. And one of the concerns that I have, as I understood the facts in this case, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you have a series of questions and answers taking place between the police officers taking Price's statement and Price's responses. When I read that language from Christensen, it would seem to me that it cannot constitute an excited utterance if you're responding to questions and having an opportunity to reflect on the statements that you're about to give. And I wanted you to briefly respond.
Sure. Based on the best reading of the facts and the reading that the trial court in its post-conviction ruling suggested was that it would have allowed this in had it been objected to as an excited utterance are these. One officer responded to Mr. Price at the scene or near the scene of the alleged crime in response to his phone call. At that point, Mr. Price was still bleeding from the gash on his head. Depending upon when the incident actually occurred, the police officer arrived at 7:30. Price said that's about the time or Price said that it was within 5 or 10 minutes that the police arrived after he called them. He had gone to a neighbor or friend's house first and had called his mother from there. Now, this is an 18-year-old boy with two prior convictions and whose willingness to maybe get police involved, you know, for other reasons may not have impacted on this. But it was in response to that officer's, where he was bleeding, the officer said he was distraught, disoriented. That's when Price made the allegation of that this was an acquaintance of Price's uncle that had done this to him.
If I could, Chief, to follow up my question. I don't think I would have, given the circumstance, I would have any question about this if the police officer arrives at the scene and Price just starts spewing out a statement and says, this is what happened. That, to me, I think under these facts would clearly qualify. I think what concerns me, particularly given the fact that he's had some time in between, he's gone actually to another location, he's making the call from there, he's had time to reflect. Now he's responding to questions. And this is an area that's always concerned me with respect to excited utterances. At what point does it lose its excited state if you're responding to questions and you have an opportunity to reflect on the answer versus giving a statement in what typically would be seen as an excited utterance situation where, you know, oh, my God, look what happened, that type of.
It's obviously a fluid situation. I know there's a case that talked about 3 or 4 hours later a sexual assault victim reporting it. You look at duration of the person and condition of the person, the shock, how long it is taking. And I would suggest here that the time frame wasn't significantly long. He was still bleeding from his cut. The officer said he was disoriented.
It's just the questioning that concerns me.
Well, he asked what happened. I mean, then Price responds to that. I don't know how else to characterize that type of response. I mean, you look primarily at whether the person that is giving the statement to police is still under some stress or shock or injury that would preclude him from concocting a story. And I would suggest that these facts would support that, as the trial court found. And where you have competing, and I'll stop shortly here, where you have competing variations, that's where the trial court steps in to make that kind of an evidentiary determination, which in its discretion, barring a real wild ruling, would be appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Give me a couple of minutes on the Miranda issue.
Okay, may I just get a...
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Sorry.
No problem.
In my brief, I suggested that you might need fact-finding because it wasn't clear. You had witnesses testifying differently as to what happened when Price ran up. This is the day after. Price runs up, and an officer has taken Mr. Mayo out of the house onto the porch and is patting him down. And Price said that the officers asked him, is this the guy? And the officer, at least one of the officers, said that they did nothing, that Price just spontaneously made, that's the guy, said that's the guy. And a third officer wasn't exactly sure. In reflection and with the benefit of colleagues' wisdom, I think there probably was enough here to have a Fifth Amendment violation. In other words, there was probably, the test is the test stated in Adams. I'll try to get it quickly here. The state, and we're talking about substantive use of evidence, not impeachment use of the right to silence. In other words, where the state's using it as case in chief.
Okay.
Yeah, right. The state may not make substantive use of pre-Miranda silence to suggest guilt if the silence was induced by or in response to government action, which typically is going to be custody and questioning. Here you've got at least a temporary custody where the officer is patting him down, probably enough that the state should not have made a comment on that in its substantive case. But the lack of prejudice here in part stems from the fact that right before the jury was selected and before opening statements, defense counsel made it clear that Mr. Mayo was going to testify. So it's clear that there wasn't any impact on his decision to testify by that. And in fact, Mr. Mayo then, during his own testimony, said, I didn't remain silent, but I did deny doing this. And the third aspect of this is that this isn't an identification case. Both of these people at least had some acquaintance with each other. Both acknowledged that this incident occurred. It was really what happened at that occurrence that was the gist of the case. Plus, as I indicated earlier, knowingly or not, Mr. Mayo, in his testimony, actually admitted a robbery as well as a battery. The question would be whether there was sufficient proof of an armed robbery, and I would submit that the gash on the head is pretty significant evidence of that.
Mr. Feimuth, are you basically saying that perhaps there was error here, but it was harmless?
Exactly, yes. In my brief, I wasn't convinced there was error because of the uncertainty whether this should be characterized as sufficient government action that would have put him in this conundrum of do I say something or not. But probably because he was being patted down, even under the best state of facts for the state, probably was sufficient to implicate his right to silence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Finley.
Thank you. First, if I could just note, Mr. Mayo did not admit to a robbery. Under established Wisconsin law, there is a limited right of self-help. One cannot reclaim money from someone to whom they claim their debt is owed, from whom a debt is owed, but they can use self-help to reclaim the precise bills and coins that were taken from them. I'm drawing on that from Edwards versus State, 49 Wis Second, 105. More recently, State versus Pettit, 171 Wis Second, 627. Just wanted to clear that up.
There's no evidence in this record that they're the same bills, though, right?
I'm sorry?
There's no evidence in this record that they're the same bills, are they?
Yes, there is. Mr. Mayo said he gave him $35, and then when he didn't get his cocaine, he took the same $35 back. So that's the same bills and coins. There's no evidence of any other bills and coins. The second thing, if I could just briefly, Justice Butler, on your excited utterance question, I'd also note that in addition to the time to reflect and compose one's thoughts and the questioning, the police officer indicated that his conversation with Clarence Price lasted about 30 minutes, I believe. So again, that was more opportunity for reflection.
But if I could ask you about that, the one concern that I have about the excited utterance argument, let's say I agree with you that this doesn't constitute an excited utterance, and inadmissible hearsay came in early in the trial, because we're talking about the first witness. Both Price and Mayo testified. So why isn't this a case of no harm, no foul? Because the state certainly could have put that evidence in after each of those individuals testified. So I'm not quite sure, while I'm not sure it's an excited utterance, I'm not sure why it should matter here.
It's the same harm you get any time you introduce excessive prior consistent statements that are inadmissible. It allows the prosecution to repeat that version of the story endlessly before the jury, reinforcing it. Plus, you get to introduce it through the police officers, indicating to the jury, this is the official line. This is the official police version of the story.
So my question is this. Once Price testifies, once Mayo testifies, contrary to what Price told the police, wouldn't the state be able to argue, well, look, this comes in under one of the exceptions as non-hearsay?
I don't know what exception that would be. It would not be a prior inconsistent statement. It wouldn't meet the requirements for a prior consistent statement. So, no, I don't believe it would come in at that
point. Would come. All right. Thank you.
The third thing I'd like to, with some trepidation, I wade into this again, because I think neither my thinking nor my articulation was very clear on the question of the role that the judge's credibility finding should play. Listening to the discussion here, I think here's what I think really is the proper role of the credibility determination, and that is that a trial judge's credibility judgments are significant as to factual determinations that are left to the trial court to make, but not as to the factual determinations as about guilt or innocence, because those determinations are reserved to the jury. And this jury never had a fair opportunity to make those judgments. The trial court's general global sense of credibility is not a proper consideration at this point, because that goes to the question of guilt or innocence, which is the jury's province.
I didn't look at the record, Mr. Finley. I just looked at the appendix. And the decision of the trial court is set forth here. Is there a separate findings of fact and conclusions of law that the...
Not labeled as such. No. The judge recounts sort of the
That's in the decision.
In the decision,
okay.
Yes.
I just want to know.
Yes.
Thank
okay.
you.
Third, next point I'd like to address briefly. Mr. Frymuth mentioned that there was a finding by the trial court that credited the trial lawyer's testimony that Mr. Mayo never told him about Argo McMorris. That is indeed true. However, counsel also stated that he never asked Mr. Mayo about any witnesses and that he never conducted any independent investigation. That is ineffective assistance of counsel. Turning then to the contention that when you have claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, interest of justice, and plain error, the court must first look to the interest of justice stand, I'm sorry, to the ineffective assistance of counsel standard. It seems to me that what the state is doing here is taking this additional constitutional safeguard, guaranteed exclusively to criminal defendants, that serves as a floor, and is trying to turn that into a ceiling, saying that you can't get relief unless you can meet this standard, because this standard exists, when in fact it's simply a floor to make sure that if the court doesn't exercise its discretion to grant a new trial in the interest of justice, or its authority to grant a new trial because of plain error, at least the defendant is entitled to relief if he can establish the standards for ineffective assistance of counsel.
Mr. Finley, in regard to the Miranda, I gather now the state, which we don't have to accept, agrees that that was error.
Yes.
But says it was harmless. Your position is that it was error and it is prejudicial. Is that right? Why is it prejudicial?
Yes. Well, I think it's prejudicial for several reasons. One, using silence in the state's case in chief, which is what's impermissible here. The state could use it as impeachment if Mr. Mayo testified. Using it as silent, using the silence in the state's case in chief can compel, effectively compel a defendant to testify when he might otherwise not, because the defendant might feel obliged to respond to that comment on silence. Now, in this case, Mr. Mayo indicated early on that he intended to testify. But as we all know, regardless of what somebody says at the up front, that decision is not finally made until the moment when the defendant is given the opportunity to testify. That choice is effectively taken away from Mr. Mayo by the comment on silence. Second, bringing out the comment in silence in the state's case in chief, as opposed to just doing it during impeachment, makes it a much more pronounced and important part of the case. The prosecutor used it in her opening, referred to it repeatedly throughout every witness's testimony at trial, and then returned to it in closing. That's a much more damaging use of that than if it is just mentioned in cross-examination of Mr. Mayo in closing. And finally, even if this argument, if this comment on silence didn't stand, didn't require reversal by itself, if it independently were not sufficient, it doesn't stand alone. It comes in combination with all of the other improper arguments and other errors in this case. So it adds to the prejudice that I think is otherwise there.
Thank you, Mr. Finley.
Thank you,
Mr. Frymuth, for your arguments in this interesting criminal case. The court will, that closes the hearing on 2004 AP 1592 CR, State versus Mayo. The court will take a short recess so that the students who wish to leave may leave and other students may enter the courtroom. And then we'll call our second case for the day. We're in recess.